March 29, 2024, it's WAP Pedro Show.
showers during the nights. I swear I'll come when she gets back. You see, I'm going out looking for the devil. So I can do him like he done me. Ass swinging through the flat of the steel. Sloping into the corner of my car. And spill out over.
Watch from Pedro, happy Friday. Started off John Coltrane. This is an excerpt from November 18, 1961. Eric Dolphy with him. Got Reggie Workman on the bass. And this is an excerpt from Blue Train. McCoy Tyner on the piano, Elvin Jones, of course, on the drums. Then we had Zoo, great Dutch band, with Eugene S. Robinson doing Looking for the Devil. Left Hand Path, I guess is the name of the project. But we'll get enlightened by the man himself. Brother Hughes, welcome aboard.
Thanks for having me on,
absolutely,
man.
Absolutely. So, please bring your earliest musical recollection.
My earliest musical recollection was my mom and my stepfather taking me to what was probably the East Coast version of Watt Stax. If you remember the film they made about Watts.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it was probably, 69, somewhere 70. And it's where I had kind of developed my lifelong love for Curtis Mayfield, which is really compelling because my stepfather was a journalist. And so he actually got to interview like Chaka Khan and Curtis Mayfield. And he always stood me in good stead by saying, you know, my stepson's a big fan. So I got autographed photos of Rahsaan Roland Kirk, you know, Curtis Mayfield, Chaka Khan, and Michael Jackson, strangely enough, that ended up in the pile. So that was my first musical memory, Watt Stacks. And I tell you, I don't remember much of what was happening on stage, but it and it wasn't Watt Stacks, it was like Watt Stacks, but I remember a lot about the audience, man. And in fact, that documentary they made about that big festival they had up in Harlem, it could have been that. I was young enough to have not been able to geographically figure out the difference between Brooklyn and Harlem, but it could have been that. But I remember that the action in the audience was just...
Curtis Mayfield, teenager with the Impressions, starting his own label, all that stuff. The guy was, in fact, he talked Pop Staples into, get into the secular music with the Staples Singer thing. I got to learn from Hodge because he did 13 years of drumming with Mavis. I actually got to see the last gig Mr. Mayfield got to do before that thing fell on him in Brooklyn. He was doing a tour of City Halls, and he played in Strong Beach here.
Yep.
And I saw him for free, and then the next day he flew out there, and the wind blew that thing off, and yeah, man.
You know what, man, I think about that, given my, I'm sure our time on stage, think about that all the time, actually, since then, And every now and then, my head, I'll look up and kind of glance at the rigging to see if I see anything obvious. But yeah, that's not a way to go.
This pad you grew up in, was there musical instruments?
There was a violin and a clarinet, and my first instrument that I studied was violin, and then segued from that into, I don't know why everybody laughs when I say it, but segued from that to banjo. I got into this weird banjo kick, and then, I think it was? I think it was Deliverance, man. I think that radicalized me, the movie Deliverance.
But actually, banjo goes way, if you read that Nick Tosh's book, Twisted Roots of Country Rock. Yeah, it goes back before the guitar, actually.
Yeah, yeah. It just seemed easier to me, five strings and so on. But I had the world's worst banjo teacher. He was like the guy in that movie Whiplash. They're like missing note. He's like, you're a dumb son of a bitch. That's why you missed it. I'm like, you know what, man, I don't need the abuse. So, and then I lived on a block with Sid Joe. He was a big calypso star, like in the 70s, and his son was a drummer and got me, tuned up on drums. But it was not with any great. I took to physical things much more aggressively than I did instruments, because everybody wants to get paid for it, and my mom didn't like me practicing in the house.
In my opinion, the voice is an instrument too. Let me ask you about school. Were you in the marching band or the choir, shit like that?
No, I got to school. I went to this intense high school in New York, really smart kids. And I got into competitive bodybuilding.
That was almost the same thing.
I had been a theater kid the whole time, like Captain Hook and Captain Hook, the Tin Man and the Wizard of Oz. I mean, musical theater forever. But the first thing when I was 9 years old, and keep in mind, that puts me in 1971, where all the cats were getting back from Vietnam and New York. The tone and the timbre of the city had changed. It started to get to be like a hostile, weird place. So lifting weights started to make a lot of sense to me. And by the time I got to high school, I was going out to, to Ridgewood, which is kind of near where John Gotti's stomping grounds were, just what I like to call the Mafia Gym. And I was spending insane amounts of time there, buying guns.
I just finished the Quincy Troop book with Miles Davis, and he spent a lot of time in the gym, helped get him off of heroin and shit.
Well, yeah, and he used to be a boxer, so he had that kind of...
Sugar Ray
I ended up working with Quincy Troop for a period of time. I did this men's fashion magazine called Code that was published by Larry Flint, but it was a fashion, it was a non-porn title, but people were so obsessed with the fact that Larry Flint was doing non-porn titles, they decided to bring in like a guy who could maybe divert people's attention, and that was Quincy. So,
because Mr. Troop, he's a poet, right?
Yeah, he actually was poet laureate of California until he got because they found discrepancies on his dude's record.
We could tangent like kings, right?
I'm gonna tell you a story. You'll love this. Okay, Robbie Coltrane, right?
Sure, second son.
So I play the Moore's Jazz. Oxbow plays the Moore's Jazz Festival, and I'm looking in the green room, and there's Ravi, and he's kind of eyeballing the ping pong table. At the same time, I'm eyeballing the ping pong table, and I was like, "Hey, you want to play a game?" And he's like, "Yeah." And in my head, I'm already writing the article, like, "I crush Ravi Coltrane." I said, so we start playing ping. I've been playing since I was 12, and I am smashing him. I'm like a point from match game, okay. And I'm like exulting in my head, like, "Fuck, this is gonna be great! I smashed Ravi Coltrane," and he gets the next point. He gets a point after that. He gets a point after that. Shit. It's tied, and then I fucking whiff it. It goes off the table, and Ravi Coltrane beats me.
Okay. There's a lesson somewhere there.
There's a lesson there, man. If you're the son of Alice and John, don't fuck around with it, right? So.
Okay. What was the first record you bought with your own money?
Easy. Psychedelic Shack, The Temptations.
Yeah, Temps. Okay.
I was super excited to get that. And
I remember Solid Rock, that album, right around that time.
Yep.
It's got Cloud Nine, and Does Anybody Give a Damn About the Brothers Back in Vietnam? And, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, that was, they were mighty. And that was a weird, that was in my mind like kind of like a punk rock band, if you follow
the
Temptations.
Sure, absolutely.
A lot of, like, you know.
With steps, like, right? With steps.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of weird, great, like, singing. Mental health issues in the band, the whole bit. It was a great band.
And I remember
where I bought it, too.
Where was
it?
That?
Because I was living in Crown Heights then, and I remember saving up my money and walking around with my great grandmother, and I said, I want that. And that was my first record.
Okay. And then the first gig was off that festival you saw, right?
Yeah, that was the festival. But, you know, my stepfather, when he started doing music reviews, and he was into all of that ritmo stuff, which I don't really hear too much out west, heavy-duty salsa stuff. So,
yeah.
Fito Puente, Ray Barreto, Hugh Masekela. So this was the stuff that was being played at the house, like, it almost exclusively, like, during Sundays, of course. So
did he know, because late 60s, that's last Poet time, did he know of them cats?
He did, of course, and then in a weird turn, years later, there was some spin-off rock publication, and I ended up doing an article on the last Poets that were left. So it was a weird...
Yeah, because there's been like 13 of them, right?
Yeah, exactly. Olatunde and one of the other cats, so sure. Olatunde and one of the other guys, so...
But the first version had a cat who was Puerto Rican, because when you were saying that percussion stuff, that made me think of that Felipe Luis, I think, or something... He was great.
Yeah, well, you know, Afro-Cuban stuff is very, you know, people don't, because they think, like, Puerto Ricans, and then they think, like, Mexicans. No. It's Puerto Ricans, Cubans.
Absolutely.
These are people have heavy-duty Afro, you know, influence, and they, you know, you got lots of black folks who speak, go to Panama, speak Spanish, so.
Yeah, and you know, Dizzy Gillespie, he ended up getting to that Afro-Cuban thing real heavy towards.
But, you know, it's funny, you know, when I used to work in the New York City Jazz Museum, in 1976, so the summer of 1976, that was right down the street from Studio 54.
Whoa.
And these cats would come in there. Yeah, these cats would come in there. Dexter Gordon,
wow.
Will Garner.
Tall man, Garner. Right? Dexter.
Yeah, well, you know, but keep in mind, I was 14 then, so everybody's here. to me, you know. But what I loved about it is, like, these cats would come walking in, and some of them I didn't, you know, I was a jazz head because my father was a jazz bassist. So I was tuned in. But you could tell, like, they had fucking mighty auras, man. You could tell when they walked in that there was somebody, even if you didn't know who that somebody was. It was pretty impressive, you know.
Okay. Yeah. And Diz came in?
Yeah, Diz came in. One of the things he donated was one of his horns.
Oh, so and the twisted up ones?
Yeah.
I see one of those at the Smithsonian, too.
Yeah. And then we also had Gene Krupa's drums. Which I remember being really kind of, you know, pretty happy to get to when the gym, when the place was closed. You got messing around on his drums. I was like, man, I'm playing Gene Krupa's drums,
wow,
man.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was pretty phenomenal.
Wow. Okay, look, I'm going to play some Whippin' Boy.
Yeah. Okay.
Stop your joy, Jack, or we will do it for you. We want the first thing to do is open up your boy. Watch it, step up, rock it, and you shred. You're gonna get it, you're rushing, and you stick low. So I'll go!
Thank you.
From Pedro Show, that Chuck Music started off with Whippin' Boy doing Human Farm. Then we had Elka Bong doing Initiated by Tom. Emmer with Broken Fusion. The Dream Thief Snowphonic Neither and Orchestra with Winter and Amnesica for Ingram Marshall, Eighth Movement. Guided by Voices, Why Won't You Kiss Me? Finally, Oxbow, Lovely Merc. Okay. So, did you get into the, now I'm not talking about graduating, but after school in the afternoon, the garage band, the basement band, the bedroom band?
I didn't start doing music until I was 18.
That's all right. Vincent only painted his last 10 years.
Yeah, the first band that I was in was a band called Al and the X's, and I played saxophone.
You learn that?
I taught myself.
Okay, great. Like John Fogerty, he taught himself.
I saw James Chance, and I was like, I could do that. Yeah. You know, so I actually went to a pawn shop and got myself a saxophone and started playing. And the theory behind that was, we're not going to do that industry stuff, man, all that booking agent. We're going to walk into places and play. That's it. Fuck you, we're playing. And so that's kind of what we did. I realized, you ever read that book, The Spy That Came In, Spook That Sat By The Door, about the intelligence officers who were black who came back from Vietnam, start working with the Black Panthers, and, like, you know. So I figured, he said,
COINTEL.
Yeah. A black man with a mop can go anywhere in America, right? I said, yeah. So I said, okay, a black dude with a saxophone, you don't know how many places I walk in with a saxophone. And they're like, oh, shit, cool. You know, and then I would whip out some Albert Eiler stuff, and they'd be like, okay, all right, enough of that. But no, it's not enough. Not nearly enough. We played for half an hour. That was the rule. And then we would roll out. And
now, this is still on the starboard side, because Whippin' Boy, this is port side, West Coast.
So yeah, well, this was...
When did you make the big move?
I August of 1980. I came out in August of 1980, and I didn't do anything with music when I was in New York. I had friends and, like, bands that were, like, Necron 99, one of the first kind of all-Asian punk rock bands from Step 78, James Situ. So I was dialed in. The guys in that band, Urban Blight, you know, I was on the swim team. Jamie Carrs was on the swim team with in high school. But, you know, I didn't understand the benefit of it until I was 18. And that's when I shifted over from acting to music, because acting seemed to me a lie, a steady series of lies. But music seemed to me to be really honest, aggressively honest. And so I preferred the authenticity of music, and then I made the switch. And, you know, I've done TV commercials and movies with Bill Cosby since then, but music has always helped my – it's the love.
Well, you know? Well, how'd you get out west? I mean, what made the move?
What you mean from west, east coast to west?
Yeah.
School. I came out to
school.
Stanford? Yeah, I'm a Stanford guy, so that's how I came out. So I figured I want to go someplace where I might never go on my own, like California, just to see what it was like. But it was cool, because when I left New York, the hubbub, the scuttlebutt was that, you know, punk rock was dead. You know, it was dead. So, and that's in New York. Sid Vicious died. Everybody was like, yeah, it's done. But, you know, hardcore was still thriving in California. So it was a good time. It was
absolutely
a really smart move.
So yeah. Is Whippin' Boy the first band you do out here?
No, Al and the X's.
Oh, Al and the X's. Okay. I'm sorry.
That was the first one. Yeah. And then, you know, then people in the group got tired of getting thrown out of places. You know, they weren't like into the confrontational aspect of our musical thing. So,
yeah.
So then I switched over to Whippin' Boy, me and Steve Ballinger, who's from Southern California originally. So he had this hardcore thing in his head, and we got together and created Whippin' Boy.
Can you remember the first Whippin' Boy gig?
I do. It was with the Circle Jerks and the Effigies in San Francisco.
Effigies, Chicago band.
Yeah, Chicago band. Yeah. And then it was weird, man. It was just one of those things where I'm like, fuck, our whole band is here. We should be playing. And Steve was like, yeah, we should. I go, you know what? I'm going to go ask Keith. And so I go up to Keith and go, hey, we want to play three songs before you play. Can we do that? And he was like, yeah, I don't give a shit. You can't use our instruments. But so we go to the Effigies and say, hey, you care if we – they go, go ahead. I mean, something that you can't even – you can't even do, really, you know. So Effigies go fine. And so they say, next up from L.A., the Circle Jerks. And then we come out, and people know that we're clearly not the Circle Jerks, you know. So they start throwing garbage and rocks and whatever else they can get their hands on. And we just kind of laughed and played our three songs and got the fuck off.
What was the venue?
The Farm.
I remember the Farm. Yeah. Tim Yohannan.
Yeah, well, no, the Farm was, like, down on Caesar Chavez.
Yeah, but when I played there, Tim would kind of, like, MC it. And, like, he would ask the people the opinion after the gig. Hey, what'd you think of these guys and shit? It was pretty rough. Yeah. I know he wasn't running and shit, but he was, like, when we were doing it, some like kind of MC kind of trip.
I don't remember that. But it was kind of
trippy. You get critiqued by the audience, you know.
That was the San Francisco treat, you know. And
yeah.
Darren Peligro and Klaus came up to me after that show and what did you guys just? Who are you? And so that was. And then they decided to put us in the Maximum Rock and Roll compilation, which was the Human Farm thing you played, and then, you know, off to the races. So.
And who was the other two cats?
Which ones? Whippin' Boy? Well, you had Steve Ballinger, who was, it's funny, Brandon Cruz, who played Eddie in the Courtship of Eddie's father. Yeah, he goes, you don't know how crazy it was. Apparently, they had gone to high school together to see the captain of the football team and my student president end up in Whipping Boy.
Because he was singing for a Nardcore band, right? Stalag 13
yeah.
or something.
Yeah, yeah, he was. So he knew Steve from school, but he was doing music, and Steve started doing music. And then we had his bass player, the bass player at that first show was Zimbardo's kid. If you were the guy who did the Stanford Prison Experiment, his son was a bass player. So he was the first. Yeah.
Small world.
yeah, man. He used to come to our practices. I made him out to be a hustler, though. I was like, I'm from New York. I know hustlers. Dude's a hustler, man. Yeah. So,
it's weird about bands, right? Chemistry and personalities in bands. It's not really just about technique, working instruments, people.
Yeah, but, you know, these were like the drummer at the time, this guy Dave Owens.
Yeah.
He's a pretty, end up in life, he's being a pretty phenomenal guy, man. He's like now a professor at Vanderbilt of like this totally created like biz design thing that he put together. But he's a phenomenal guy. Not the greatest drummer, but good enough, you know, for what we're doing at the time. But still.
Yeah. Now, you end up doing tours and making records.
Yes.
And this is all new for you, right?
Yeah, but it seemed like it was new for everybody. And
that's all right.
The two-step was the same. Like, I think at the time, we were friends with this woman named Marianne Scott, and she said, hey, you know, I used to work with these guys at Haagen-Dazs. Maybe they could help you. And I go, who? She said, well, one guy's name is Ian, the other guy's name is Henry, and they've done a tour already. So she gave me their phone number. So I got some, you know, in the old days, you had to put together a tour on the phone.
That's right. So Chuck Dukowski.
I got some illegal, like, card number and called Ian, and he helped us set up the first tour.
Ian had people, let the listeners know, Ian had Minor Threat and Henry had SOA.
Yeah, that's
we're
right.
At the end of the first hour. We got to get on. March 28, 2024, Dish Wap Peter, special guest, Eugene S. Robinson. Hold tight for hour two.
We played with you guys at the Keystone Palo Alto.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Yeah, and then later, Oxbow played with you at Slim's.
Right, 11th Street. Right,
yeah, I remember. Yeah.
I should tell people, March 28, 2024, second hour, what for Pedro Show.
scattered and integrated to the very soil.
on the air mattress of despair, despair. On the air mattress of despair, despair.
Speed Row Show. Start off second hour, well, with a little spiel there, recapping when we shared stage. But then we had Bunnell with Roll Call. Swive with Little Did I Know. Ben Salter out of Tasmania with Goddess. Melvin Gibbs, there's a bass player. Inner yep. Chamber. Neil Turpin, the Air Mattress of Despair. That's a drummer who decided to play everything, make his own record. It's trippy how drummers get cut short shrift, you know. Fuck
yeah.
Up. I hate that. Bombas yeah. Prendon with I See What I Think and Crackshot from Bunnell. So, yeah, hip us to Bunnell. You said you're the only non-star member.
Yeah, the non-Italian star. Yeah. Actually, one of the guys, Javi, his singer was the guy who signed Maneskin. I was like, whoa, does he still show up to band practice? He was like, no, he made so much money from signing that band that he has effectively retired from his musical life. I was like, that's funny. Nah, I don't think any amount of money would get me to do that, but okay, good for him.
But how did Bunnell come together? Well, no, you know what? That's down the road. So, because we got to leave off at Whippin' Boy, right? What happens with Whippin' Boy? Because I know after Oxbow comes down the road. So what was the path of Whippin' Boy?
Well, Whippin' Boy, you know what? It was the second record, and you've never experienced this because you've always danced to the tune of your own, you know, of your own making. But we put out The Sound of No Hands Clapping, which Tom Mallon, who used to drum for American Music Club, did. He was the guy who produced it fundamentally. And then we decided, well, we want to do something. The weird music that's in our head, effectively understood maybe as a bridge to Oxbow, was the second record called Muru Muru. And Klaus from the Dead Kennedys produced it. And it was complete. It was like going to the store and asking for toilet paper, and they gave you sandpaper. People were not. They wanted hardcore. They didn't give a shit. They wanted to know anything else about anything else. So the second record did really poorly, but it kind of taught us a few things about a few things, and it did not dissuade us at all from doing weird music. In fact, it created this divide where I was like, man, I could, you know, dance to the tune of, like, just doing hardcore or do the music that's in my head. And what made the decision final was that the lyrics that I was writing couldn't be accommodated in a 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4
format.
I couldn't do it, so I had to change the music. And, you know, left. And when Oxbow was created, there was a scissor. I purposely didn't want any connection to Whippin' Boy, so there were no credits. I didn't use any of the old familiar suspects. I didn't none of that. It was all completely, totally anonymous and new, and I think that worked in its benefit, as well as it being, it was never intended to go past the first record because I decided to make a musical suicide note. I was in a bad state of mind then and decided, this is going to be my message to the future. Fuck you all. Here you go. And, of course, the record was super well received, so it dragged me out of my doldrums, and I decided, I guess, not to fundamentally to kill myself.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
yeah,
that's
man.
A good thing. Yeah. But you know, this kind of bugged me too. Huge, same thing. The guy's saying anarchy and freedom of thought, but we all had to play the same fucking song almost.
Yeah, but you know, I understood that. I understood that what it like the guy who goes and asks for toilet paper and they give him sandpaper. 100 right. times out of 100, if he wants toilet paper, you give him toilet paper. I just decided I wasn't the toilet paper business anymore. I want to be able to give you whatever I want to give you, and if you stick with it, that's cool. If you don't stick with, I mean, and consequently, Oxbow's oeuvre, I start to feel like there's not a single record, not a single note on that any of those records that was the wrong note. They were 100% all the right notes. And if you don't like it, I understand that, but you can't tell me it's a bad record. Any of the Oxbow records, they were exactly as they were intended to be. And
do you remember the first Oxbow gig?
Yeah, I do. And it was life-changing. It was in London. We did a Whippin' Boy show where we played Oxbow. The last Whippin' Boy show was like with Social Distortion, and we played like Oxbow songs. And that people were like, they're kind of confused. But then we went to London. And Kevin Martin from that group, The Bug, brought us over. We played the Union Tavern, and I did this show. I did a reverse. So the last Whippin' Boy show was like Whippin' Boy playing Oxbow tunes, but when we finally played Oxbow tunes, it was like a Whippin' Boy show. And this guy Stevie Chick wrote a review for
Stevie Chick. I know him. He's a writer. Yeah,
he's a writer, and he wrote a review for Sounds Magazine, and he goes, I really love this Oxbow record. I didn't love the live show so much. And he point by point went through what I hated about my show because it was a holdover from the Whipping Boy thing. And it completely changed my approach to, I was like, what he's saying is that fundamentally it's inauthentic. And I go, he's 100% right. It's been bugging me. How do I address that? And from that, that was the last show I ever played like that. What I did after that is get on stage, stand in front of the microphone, and the music pulled it out of me. What happened after that? The music pulled out of me. I didn't come in with a preconceived. I did let the music determine the flow of the show, and that's been what I've done ever since, and it's worked for me. So,
in a trippy way, a journalist kind of helped you.
Hey, man, I'm a journalist as well, so I realized that.
You said your step-pop was one too, right?
Yeah, you know, he was not very helpful. It was really funny. Like, he speaks Spanish, and I'm taking Spanish since I'm 5 years, and I'm barely, like, conversing, you know. I was like, how come I don't speak Spanish? He's like, I don't know. And he never was really helpful with the writing either. So, you know, but it was something that I did without pause. As soon as I could write, I started writing, and I didn't really give a shit who liked it or didn't like it. It was purely for myself, so.
That's the way it goes. I think it's healthy. You know, you gave me this stuff I ain't heard before, this tune called I Want to Kill You.
you got to recognize some of that playing on it, don't you? You got to.
It's really good. I mean, it's really good. It's Chuck Dukowski?
Yeah, we did a project together.
respect. Let's play it.
You won't get away. The only high school teacher I had who made a lasting impression on me was Doug Hostler. At school, we called him Mr. Hostler.
He was the crafts teacher. He was only about a dozen years older than us.
He became friends with three classes of students, those who graduated in 1971, 1972, that's me, and 1973.
He'd invite us out to his house in the countryside that he shared with his wife, Penny, who was an English teacher at a different school.
He treated us as equals, curious about our interests.
He turned us on to Kerouac, experimental theater, poetry, philosophy, and the cosmos.
The only high school teacher I had who made a lasting impression on me was Doug Hostler. At school, we called him Mr. Hostler.
One day at school, he and I were talking in the hallway between classes. He took scissors out of his shop apron and cut off his tie at the knot and handed it to me.
On the surface, this was a very cool thing he did. But I felt like it meant more. So I mounted it to a board, and it's hung in my home for 50 years.
The only high school teacher I had who made a lasting impression on me was Doug Hostler. At school, we called him Mr. Hostler.
He only taught for a few years. His main work became the ceramics he made in the studio beside his house.
He would make the rounds of craft fairs where stores would order pieces that he'd go home and make.
He grew weary of that cycle and turned his attention to raising orchids.
The only high school teacher I had who made a lasting impression on me was Doug Hostler. At school, we called him Mr. Hostler.
After Penny retired, they moved from Pennsylvania to Arizona, and we stayed in touch with letters and postcards until he died.
The only high school teacher I had who made a lasting impression on me was Doug Hostler. At school, we called him Mr. Hostler.
Thank you. Oh.
Watch for Pedro Show. Start that chug off with Blackface. I Want to Kill You. J.D. Pincus and Tall Trees with Zeno Raises the Dead. David Greenberger and Tyson Rogers with Mr. Hostler. Yu Chang, Take Human Form. Eugene Chadbourne, I Vaporize. And Man Gene with The Amber of Heaven. And enlighten us about this Blackface project with Chuck Dukowski.
Yeah, man. That was, yeah, like he was, I was doing a spoken word thing. He said, I want to play behind you. I go, yeah, you should play behind me. So it'd be great. And then we said, hey, let's, you know, dig no graves before it's time. We should do something together. And he goes, I have this idea. And he said, so all the songs for Black Flag that I've written that didn't get played as Black Flag, we could do. And I go, I'm down. And he goes, what are we going to call it? He goes, let's call it Blackface. And I was like, that's the most genius name. Probably we're the only people that could get away with it, you know? And
kind
he
was like, all
right. Yeah.
Kind of minstrel, a little bit.
Yeah, a little. So then he comes up.
You know, I read about that minstrel. You know, it's in that Nick Tosh's book. It's a big thing behind country and rock and shit.
Yeah.
We're talking 100 years ago, 150 years ago.
Well, you know, the thing is, I'm a big Al Jolson fan, and people are like, Al Jolson? So look, Al Jolson, this is what they did during the day. Yeah. But Al Jolson was one of the first big civil rights, poured a lot of money into civil rights. He was not a piece of shit himself at all.
Yeah.
So,
it's hard for people to understand because they ain't in those times, you know.
Yeah,
so anyway, so you and Chuck, this came together. What, you come down here and guys just got in the studio?
Yeah, we both, he and Milo, his stepson.
Yeah.
They came up a couple times, and then me and Tom Dobroff, who was Oxbow's original drummer.
Yeah.
We drove down a couple of times, and then we recorded. Monty Valier, who was in that group Swell, had a studio in San Francisco, and we recorded two or three songs, and then we had five. Total Hydrahead at the time agreed to put it out, and then we got the support slot at the Off Festival in Poland for Iggy Pop, and I was getting hyped up for it, and that's where Chuck was like, I can't do it.
Oh, fuck. Yeah. What about Man Gene?
Man Gene, this is Alex Bwess, the sax player, you know, who's up there in my mind a lot with Brotsman. He had like a brush with death, and then God said, fuck this. He's lost weight, got serious about, and he started, he goes, I want you guys to do this project. And it's Manuel Liebskin, a Swiss guy who lives in Berlin, and it was heavily influenced by Aphex Twin. And he goes, I want to do this thing. It's not your typical style, what you've been doing with Oxbow, but I think you'd fit perfectly with it. And so we did it. And he just
I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, it's not typical for what I've done.
So it was kind of put together by some other cat, and you were a component.
Yeah, well, Manuel has known us for a long time. He was in a Swiss band called Silence Cries and has done a bunch of stuff. Yeah, he used to be the road manager for Melt Banana, you know.
Yeah, Tokyo.
But he, you know, is a musician, guitar player, multi-instrumentalist himself. So he's been sitting on this thing, and Alex put the fire under his ass to finish. He flew out to San Francisco about 3 months ago. We climbed tops of really tall buildings and did the video.
So this is really recent then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Bitches.
Yeah, he just had to be on a rooftop like back in January. So, yeah.
Wow. I love it. Yeah. Up to the moment, people. Four years just went by. We're at the end of the second hour. March 28, 2024 edition, Wap Pedro Show, special guest Eugene S. Robinson. We'll type hour 3. March 28, 2024, it's the third hour, Wap Pedro Show.
What the winter remember, the candle. What was left was damn near nothing at all. Could you help an old altar boy, father? 'Cause I'm down on my luck. Say no one in particular. Could you help an old boy father who is down on his luck?
I'm floating beyond the galaxies, beyond the pulsars, beyond the quasars, beyond the quaaludes, beyond the Motorolas. David Bowie's prong has been disentangled from the methane snogules of barbed wire X-Lax at the trash heap in the prognosis on the two towers, on the old and the new, on the tension beneath the organic beings which had seen their molecules become part of the earth. And from a God's eye view, I looked down upon the world, and I saw a blue globe against the void of black infinity, the void of black infinity, the void of black infinity, a blue globe pitted against the void of black infinity, black infinity, black infinity, black infinity. And through my God's eye view, above the world, beyond the world, I saw beings rise up out of the world, made of molecules of the earth, assembled from the air and the waters and the ground of the earth, assembled in their mother's uteruses into organized structures known as human beings, which wandered around on the surface of the earth from whence they had come, and that at the end of their lives they again became part of the earth. And the earth was like a large Alka-Seltzer. And the human beings were but little carbonated bubbles fizzing off the Alka-Seltzer for a moment or so and then becoming part of the Alka-Seltzer again. And they lived and died in a brief instant against the vast darkness of infinity. And the human beings rose up and they fought amongst themselves, even though they were made of the same molecules, and when they died, they would begin become intermingled. Their molecules would become intermingled. It was as if the earth was rising up against itself to hate and war and torture and kill and cause agony, only to fall down and die and become part of the earth. And I saw a human being, and he fell and he died and he became part of the earth, and his molecules fell into the earth and became part of the earth, and the birds and the trees and the clouds and the skies and the waters, and flowed out. And some of these molecules of the earth and the air and the trees and the birds and the flowers and the clouds and the skies and the mountains became integrated into other molecules in future human beings who were assembled in their mother's uteruses, who were issued from their mother's uteruses out into the world to dance about on the surface of the world for a little while and to foment hatred against themselves as pieces of the earth. The earth foments hatred against itself in the form of petty humans who will die and whose molecules will be intermingled amongst themselves and amongst the earth and the mountains and the trees and the skies and the birds and the other human beings and the waters and the oceans for eternity. And a human life is but a mere carbonated bubble which appears for an instant against the eons and millennium of eternity. And these human beings strut around like pompous little jackasses, thinking that everything they do is cool and that their lives are somehow transcend everything around them, when they will be pummeled down to become mere molecules of the earth which surrounds them. And every time they urinate, they realize that they are merely a conduit for the water which they ingest, and which again becomes part of the earth which they had ingested but hours before. And they're constantly sloughing off molecules of their beings to begin become part of the world from whence they were generated. And they're only here for an instant, and then they fall down into the earth again. But no, they never think about these things. They have to go to the mall to get new clothes, or they gotta get a good job, or they gotta get a good promotion, or they gotta acquire numbers in their bank accounts. Meanwhile, they're very rapidly going towards their deaths. Very, very rapidly. Every second that they live is gone forever. Very rapidly towards their deaths. Meantime, wasting it with meaningless activities, creating nothing of permanent value, as they will soon be mere disorganized, chaotic molecules again. Mere disorganized, chaotic molecules again. Mere disorganized, chaotic molecules again. Nature, some organisms dominate other organisms with teeth and claws and talons and superior physical strength and crushing jaws with which they shred and devour their prey. And this is the law of nature, and this is the order of nature, that one organism must prey on another organism for its survival. But human beings are afraid of the natural order. But they have created their own order in the world, in which some human beings dominate other human beings with money and lies. Money and lies are how human beings dominate each other. Money and lies. Lies and money. Money and lies. Lies and money is how you desiccate and destroy and kill those beneath you. money and lies, lies and money, money and lies, lies and money. Climb to the top of the shit pile and destroy those beneath you with money and lies, lies and money, lies and money.
Walk for Pedro show. Start off the third hour. Eugene S. Robinson and Philippe Petit with Remember Me, You Three. John Truby after that with Money, Lies, Carbonated Bubbles. And then Oxbow with Peter Bronson, who we just lost a few months ago. Great cat.
Yeah.
Cat and Mouse, live. Where was this done? On tour in Europe somewhere?
That was the Moors Jazz Festival. Okay. That's where the Robbie Coltrane kicked my ass in ping pong.
Okay.
But, you know, what they do there is they say it's not enough just to play. Any idiot can play. We want to do uncomfortable pairings. So you got to be down for them. No, we're down. We're down.
Yeah.
So not only do we do the thing with Brotsman, but I end up doing something with some, like, African tribal band. It was actually pretty phenomenal. Pretty cool.
What about this thing with Philippe Petit?
We've been doing records together for a long time. We did a Chapel in the Pines. That's me and Percy Howard, who had done with Laswell and Material.
Sure.
And then I've done a record with Lydia Lunch, some songs for him, like Cleanliness is Next to Godliness, I think. And then the last of the Dead Hot Lovers. So he pretty much was getting a bunch of money to do these things, and was like, the last one that we never finished, which killed me, was going to be me and Shannon from the Cows on vocal.
Oh, wow.
And that would have been great, but the money stopped coming, so we just stopped doing it. But that would have been I'm bemoaning having missed that, but these are pretty cool. I mean, the last of the Dead Hot Lovers, essentially, you know, two 22-minute songs about the last hours of a relationship. So it's a pretty – and it was actually, like, ended up being really true, so it was a nice piece of work to have
like
been
a document. What were the situations? You come walking into this with music already be done, and you'd bring your spiel, or
it's like the thing I did with Jamie Stewart from Juju. Like, you said, okay, let's do
we're gonna play that next chunk. Sunset 69. Okay.
Yeah, he says, let's do 8 songs, and then he switched up on me. He goes, I changed my mind. I go, what? He goes, I got 22 songs. Here you go. They're different.
So
I was like, yeah, man, I met the challenge. Wrote lyrics, came up with vocal lines for them all. So this was like that. Petit would send it, and I think Last of the Dead Hot Lovers, we recorded in Prague, and then I had to go back and record the second half in Berlin with this woman, Kasia Miao, who is actually now my wife. So she was singing for a Polish group at the time called Terrible Disease, and now Maneki Necro. So it was
Maneki Necro. That's the little welcoming cat.
Exactly.
Okay, so is this where you met her?
I met her in Poland. Yeah. So
okay,
Oxbow tour. So
okay.
Yeah,
look,
yeah.
You gave me this. Now this is from a while ago. Stranger by Starlight, says 2013, and the Red Paint, also known as the Last Days of the Sinner.
Yeah.
Give us a little preface before I play it.
Anthony Saggers is, I think, bona fide musical genius. Yeah, like lots of bona fide musical geniuses, he's also bipolar. So we did a couple of projects together, and then he lost his mind on me and accused me of stealing his music.
Uh-oh.
And I go, how would I do that? You know, I clearly don't play an instrument, so we made up.
I think the voice is an instrument. I think you play that instrument very well.
Yeah, but it's not nothing that I stole.
It's not a machine. So, okay.
Yeah, we got over our difficulties and went about doing it, but then, you know, we had one label, and then the label, you know, it's a label trip. They fold, and then what are you going to do? But we went over it, and we haven't played a show at all, but we just keep making these, you know, these things, and I'm he's so good, so good.
Praises. To which I am wed. thoughts. That after all, when all is done and said, we should have killed him a lot quicker than we did. She explained to him slowly what the witches had already told him. He was done for by us his life. That as the sun moves across the sky, his wife named Esther, glorious, untroubled, and unstriving. And let me see inside all of it, inside of their life. And it seemed like his heart would break. And I yawned. Done doing face to Dan Romopoulos. She offers you a handful of rain. Seems like first. Esther has always been nothing but sitting just the side of the hopper, where it all slides down. You cry, and there is no one here stopping you. Because it rains on the just and the unjust alike, my friend. Shift onto my side in the face of your face, sorrow. And stretch out long, leaning across a place that you won't see tomorrow again. But Esther handles a heavy lifting. Slide of hopelessness into and over all of which it cannot even grow. We should have killed him quicker than we did.
smell it, and it smells like fall. And pockets that know no end, we will and can end. More than you have to want to give you more of what you want to have. I smell it, and it smells like food. And pockets that know no end of what we will and can ask. More than you have to want, to give you more of what you want to have. Says what it means. It's green, so green. It's green, so green. And it's green, so green.
Live from Feed Rush, your last music for this edition. We started that chunk off with Stranger by Starlight, the Red Print, also known as The Last Days of the Sinner, 2013. Tripod Jimmy after that, Franco America. That's Tom Herman's band after he quit Peru. David Gerard with K2, the Expedition. I think that's the second tallest summit next to Everest. And then finally, Shushu, Eugene S. Robinson. Sunset 69. I guess this is part of the 22 songs he foisted on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Challenged you with.
And we called it Sal Mineo.
Whoa.
And yeah.
Speaking of drummers, right? He played the Gene Krupa story.
Yeah. Good for you. That's right. Yeah. People don't. Yeah.
And he got stabbed to death in a fucking Hollywood alley.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Fucked up.
Yeah. He's a tragic character in a lot of ways, but. Yeah,
He's also the young guy in Rebel Without a Cause. He kind of gets Jimmy Dean in trouble.
Right. So then we put this record out, and his family contacts me. Right?
Whoa!
Man, they're still in the Bronx, some of his family, and they're like, thank you for doing this tribute to, you know, our uncle. And I'm like, cool, man, can you? So I was, like, friendly with the family for a period of time when this record came out. But what was funny about this music, you can hear it. It's kind of plangent, kind of quiet, a little bit noisy, but kind of, in general, quiet.
Yeah.
But we got into more fistfights on the tour that we did than Osmo ever has. we played in Brussels, and some guy, you know, it's a quiet stuff. It's just two of us, and some guy is like, just giving me a hard time, and pretty much the shorthand is, once you force me to acknowledge you in this way, I got to make you part of the show. Right? I have to. So, and especially if I step off the stage, and the guy's just hollering nonsensical stuff, and I step off the stage, and I go, is it your desire that I strike you to quiet? And I, you know, you get kind of, you know, articulate in these moments, and the guy says, do what you have to do. And I was like, he's pretty much asked for this. And so I, like, knocked him off of his feet. It's like Charlie Brown when, he gets hit with the baseball and this stuff went all over. And Jamie, of course, is not used to this. He's like, what up? He just keep playing. He made a decision just to keep playing, and that was the perfect thing to do, you know. So.
What's going on right now with you with music?
Big deal. We got, Oxbow's got one more show stateside in Minneapolis at the Catawal Festival this May, and then we come back and then go off in end of June, 2 weeks with Bungle, Spotlights, and Cunts, kind of Epicac Showcase. Whoa. 2 more weeks in Europe.
Yeah.
We come back And then I go out again with Bunuel in, cause Bunuel has a double album coming out called Mansitude coming out in September. So we go out again with Bunuel in October, November for 2 or 3 weeks.
And
so,
who's, is same guys in Oxbow?
Same guy, yeah, same guys in Oxbow, man.
Okay, Jesus.
1988.
Yeah, Veteranos.
I mean, if you think, Oxbow started with two drummers.
Yeah.
So Tom Dobroff, who was in Blackface, was the first drummer. Well, I mean, he was one of the drummers, and then he decided he wanted to go off to get his PhD in anthropology. So he left, and then the other drummer that started with us, Greg Davis, has been the one who's been with us since then. So, and he was the one who, I think he played on the first Albini record that Albini did for us was Tom drumming, and the second Albini record, Serenade in Red, which was on SST, had Greg drumming. So Greg, that was the divide between Tom and Greg. So
okay, and Bunuel, you guys did a double album? Where'd you record it?
This is the fourth record, so the first three were like a trilogy.
Yeah.
And then we met these guys in Milan, Overdrive Records, pretty crafty Sicilian guys, who ended up buying a vinyl pressing plant. And now they're like, they can't even keep count of the money. So much of it's coming in. Like, they're pressing records for Bjork and just everybody.
Right.
So they decided, well, shit, we're going to start a label because what are we going to do with all this money? So they gave Bunuel an ungodly amount of money by record standards, you know. We recorded some of it in Italy, and then the rest of it we recorded at Monty's place. Monty from Swell again.
Okay, sure. So you do got a lot of stuff coming out right now.
If you take that and the memoir, that just because I'm going to be at Kiss Kiss Tattoo in Venice on Sunday.
Here, Sunday. In Cali, not Italy, yeah. Venice.
Yeah, okay. No, in Cali on Easter Sunday at 4 o'clock.
Wow.
And the memoir has been, you know, pretty cool, too, which is, you know, A Walk Across Dirty Water and Straight into Murderer's Row. So Feral House put it out.
Feral House, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Man. So I pretty much go from birth to the creation of Oxbow, because I'm not writing a 600-page book.
You got Quincy Troop to help you.
Yeah, man. Keep it under 300 pages. Make it an easy claim.
Right. You know? So where can people find you on the internet?
Everywhere. You know, Instagram, Mr. Sleep 3.
Do you got your own website, though?
Yeah, I do, but it's fallen fallow because, you know, when Facebook comes in and, you know, it's just easier to do it through Facebook. So Eugene S. Robinson on Facebook.
Okay, go to the corporate place, people. Yeah, you'll see a flyer stapled up on that telephone pole.
Yeah, exactly right. So
Can I put the invite out? Anything new you got coming like this double album? When this thing comes out, will you come back on the show? We can play it and talk about it?
I will. I'm going to be over after the Bungle tour in June. Yeah. I go to Bilbao and going to take a transport to Basque Country.
Yeah.
And there's a black sand beach there. And we're going to spend 10 days recording all the videos for this Bunuel record, which is a monster. So
Wow. Can't wait. Thank you so much. Such honor to have you aboard, Huge. Truly.
Thanks for having me, Mike. This has been great.
We keep on keeping on, people. That's just the way it is. It's been the March 28, 2024 Dishy Watt Pedro Show. Keep your powder dry.